Okay, I think we'll start, we can start rolling the tape. I guess, at least some of you know that who I am now, I'm Jim Knutson, and the reason I'm talking about South Africa today is that, first of all, my wife and I were in South Africa from 1954 to 1972 as missionaries of the Lutheran Church, and then from 73 up until the end of last year, I was one of the secretaries for the mission board, mission division, first of all for ALC, and then for 2 years in Chicago with the ELCA. And part of my area of concern and responsibility was South Africa. So, and we have a son and a daughter-in-law who are serving there now as missionaries under our church too, so that's another point of contact. What I would like to do, there are going to be 3 days we're talking about South Africa. Today is an overview, and general overview, setting some of the context, some of the things that you already know perhaps, but just to make sure we kind of start on the same wavelength to some extent. Then tomorrow, how did South Africa get the way it is? A brief historical review, but trying to put together some of the pieces in the puzzle. And as I say, it's some perspectives, because all of this, of course, is some perspectives. It's such a complex situation, so incredibly complex, that one can only say you're sharing some perspectives. And then the third day, which will be on Thursday, the third day of the South African series, talking about the church and the church's struggle and what the church is doing in the throes of apartheid in South Africa. And then the last day, which is a general, will be, is there really a two-way street? Is there really a mutuality in mission? Or is it all coming from us to people in other countries? So today it's an overview, and I realize I'm going to touch a number of things, and I'm willing to entertain any questions, but if it's something that we will be dealing with in the next 2 days, I'll say, well, let's, you know, please come back. But certainly ask the question, and if it's related to some of the historical background, we may get into it tomorrow. But don't be afraid to ask questions. I want to start with a little bit of an overview, and then we'll have slides which will give a general pictorial overview of the country and the church, very general. I'd like to start by reading a quote from Charles Villavicencio, another white South African professor in Cape Town University, who wrote an article for Americans in Sojourners about two years ago now. And this was a whole issue on South Africa for Americans. And he says two things here, and I'll summarize what he's saying, which I would like you to keep in mind during these next days. First of all, number one, he says, I don't think that Christians in the United States or in other parts of the world are really in a position to minister to us until they've dealt with the fundamental issues of racism and economic injustice within their own countries. And then he goes on to say that, this is 88, that one of the reasons that the regime in South Africa continues to exist is because of economic support from the states and so forth. So the first point is that as we look at racism in South Africa, and it's certainly not your first look, it should also be a mirror and a reflection for us. What about racism and oppression and other kinds of oppression right in our own country? And so we realize it's not an either or, it's not only there or here, it's both. And how can these situations inform one another? Second point is, as he points out here, that what you're witnessing in South Africa is not some sort of a strange society or strange aberration. We are the world in microcosm. And that's another very helpful point to remember. South Africa, where you have a minority of whites, majority of blacks and other colors, where a minority of whites control the wealth, control the situation over a majority of blacks. In a sense, it's a microcosm of the world in which we live, where we whites basically, now you can say together with Japan, control the economic wealth, the might of the world, and yet the majority of the people in the world are not white. So those two points. Now, the overview very briefly, I put some facts up here on the board. We're talking, of course, I don't want to insult anyone's intelligence, but someone came in a little while ago and said, well, what are you really talking about? We're talking about the Republic of South Africa, which is a country at the tip of the continent. We're not talking about Namibia today or about Botswana or other countries, even as important as they are. The Republic of South Africa at the tip, which is about 1/7 the size of the continental United States, to give some idea of the size. The population, and you get different figures, but this is, I've gotten this from some, I'd say it's as good as any, and it gives, the important thing here to me is the racial. The blacks, 27 million, about 75%. Not blacks, when we say blacks, we remember that in South Africa, people are classified according to race. And you could just say, well, why don't you just say there are 36 million people in South Africa and be done with it? But then you miss the dynamics of the ratio. And so the blacks, 27 million, the coloreds, the mixed race, we call them mulattoes. That is a specific classification. You carry a classification saying your color. We'll come back to some of these things later. The Asians that came from India to work in the sugar fields were brought over to work in the sugar fields, 1 million. The whites, 5. So there you get the ratio somewhat of the situation. 14% of the people are white, 15%. They control 87% of the land. We will come back and talk at several times about the homelands, but you can see, I hope at least, even if it's not so clear, the colored portions of this map. These are the homelands, the 10 ethnic homelands, where the Africans are told, this is your land, this is your country, this is where you can have your political rights, and where these homeland governments have had a certain amount of independence. And there are 10 different homelands, 10 different ethnic groups. This is a land that's, this is African land, and the rest is white land. Nearly half of the Africans now live in the homelands, one way or the other. Nearly half of them. Now, there is migratory labor, and we'll be talking about that, about what happened when they discovered gold and diamonds. Another thing that's happened during these past years, and if you look at this map a little more closely, you'll see a number of arrows. And those arrows show removals. And about 3.5 million black people have been removed, have been resettled by the government back to their ethnic homelands. Because if you're a Zulu, your homeland is KwaZulu, Zululand. This is your homeland. If you're a Xhosa, it's the Transkei or the Ciskei. There are two homelands. If you're Tswana, it's Bophuthatswana. Tswana. And the arrows show people being moved from small settlements, from farms, from what was called black spots, moved into the homelands. And sometimes way from Cape Town, way back into Transkei. 3.5 million. Some facts about the situation. The per capita income in South Africa, and again, it's a ratio because the figures may vary, 14,000 rand, a little more than that, to 1,000, so 14 to 1. Now this will vary. You'll find a corporation where blacks are getting the same as whites. But this is taking the whole population, like any country. It's only for comparison. Yeah.
What's the conversion rate for rand to dollar?
About 38 U.S. cents for a rand. So you multiply this to 0.38. As far as the Africans go, a dollar, it's pretty much the same. I mean, for them, if they're going to buy something for they would get for a rand about what we'd get for a dollar. But again, it's a comparison that about that ratio. And like all comparisons, you know, you can say, well, I know an African who's making, you know, as much as a white, but this is the general ratio. Okay, infant mortality is 10 times higher in some of the homelands. In some of the homelands, 50% of the children die before the age of 5. Especially in some of these large homelands where the health services and the whole situation has deteriorated these past years, as more and more people have been moved back there, and there's less and less services for them. About 1/3 of under 14 age blacks have nutritional deficiencies, again, basically in the homeland areas. And the patient-doctor ratio, according to the latest figures I got, 400 to 1 for whites and 90,000 to 1 for blacks. You can, you know, again, you can say, well, maybe it's 80,000. Okay, still very high. Okay, that's some of the situation. Now, one other thing before we look at the pictures, there have been changes in South Africa, and we'll talk especially tomorrow about this historical flow. But the basic pillars, which made apartheid what it is, are still in place, and these are the basic pillars of apartheid. The Land Act of 1913, which was amended in 1936, that's wrong, it's not 26. The Land Act basically said that blacks cannot own any land in white areas, and they cannot buy any land in white areas, and they must stay in their own areas. In other words, you could be a rich black man, and you can't go out and say, hey, I'd like to buy that farm. You can't do it. That was put into concrete way back, 1913. Influx control, 1945, the influx of Africans into the city. So to come into the city, you had to have a permit. You could be in there 3 days, and then after that, you had to have a job. You didn't come in the city and just roam around. You had to have a stamp saying you were allowed to be in the city. You controlled the influx of people from these homelands. There were modifications of this, but the Aliens Act of 78, you can't read that, and the Squatters Act of 89 tightened it up. So then one way they loosened it, so they tightened it. So it still means there's not freedom of movement for black people in South Africa. That's basically it. Third, population registration, where people were classified. And that was one of the first acts when the Nationalists got into power in 1948. You are an African. You got a thing that says you are an African. You are colored, you are Asian, you are white. And everything then flows out of that. We'll talk more about that. Group areas, again, solidified the fact there are areas for whites and areas for blacks. Made it really, really put it in the law. Bantu education, called Bantu education, education for blacks. Because the Afrikaners back there said, the government said, black person are going to be hewers of wood and drawers of water, and they're going to be servants, and they're going to do all this kind of stuff. There's no need to educate them to do more sophisticated things. So they had their own education department, their own way of being educated, and it was called Bantu education. Homeland citizenship in 1970, people who lived in some of the homelands which became independent were deprived of South African citizenship. Now, South African citizenship was second class, but at least you were considered South African. And when, for instance, a pastor would come over here on an exchange program or South African, they did have a passport that said they're South African. After that, they were deprived of the citizenship. South Africa was trying to push people away and say, these countries are independent and we're only going to give them some money. So that was another thing, very controversial, about 8 million people lost even a second-class citizenship and got even a third-class. Then there were many acts, Internal Security Act of 82 and other acts, which meant you could be detained indefinitely without trial. There were all kinds of acts, Police Act, Prisons Act, which buttressed this thing, which made it very, it could be thrown into jail for indefinite time. And that was, so that kind of buttressed the whole thing. Okay, now we're going to look at the slides and get an overview. You can ask questions during that, and I hope you have a few minutes afterwards, and then we'll have the next two periods as well. So we will get the machine here. Okay, as you saw on the map, and as you know, South Africa lies at the tip of the continent, and it is where the two oceans meet, the city of Cape Town, with the Table Mountain in the background. There are some very beautiful parts of South Africa. It is sometimes thought of as one of the most beautiful countries and yet one of the most troubled countries in the world. This is in Natal, not too far from the Indian Ocean. There, we've already talked about the fact that there are about 27 million black people and the division of the population. These are black children, African children in the city, in the Sunday school in Soweto. Land has been a constant problem as the white people moved into the interior and claimed the land. This is in the Orange Free State. Orange Free State looks very much like the western plains of our country. It's fairly good farming land, corn, and they raise cattle there. A little farther south is wheat. And again, 87% of the land controlled by about 14% of the people. The homeland system, which I alluded to earlier, has meant more and more and more people being moved into rural areas. And this is in Natal, Zulu, KwaZulu. You can see more and more, I would say not too many years ago, you look in that valley, there would be just a couple homesteads. The Zulus, by the way, live in what is called kraals, or they have a different word for it. They're separate homesteads. They don't live in villages. So each homestead, and those were extended families, and they used to be, that'd be an extended family, where a man in the early tradition would also have several wives, probably, and the grandparents, and any unmarried brothers and sisters, so each homestead. But now they're moving in, so there's less and less land. And obviously, these are people, the men are forced, and sometimes the women, to go into the city of Durban, in this case, to find work, because the land will not sustain them. the homeland of Venda up in the northern, way up in the northern tip of South Africa. Very crowded homeland. Some of you may have heard Dean Farisani speak, Chinyawani Farisani. This is his homeland. This is where he comes from, where he comes. And it's a poor and more and a rockier homeland even than Natal, and again, very overcrowded. These people live in small villages, and again, the land will not sustain them. And again, in Natal, the homeland, again, you see that the people are moving in more and more. So the fact that you say this is your land and you can have your citizenship here and you can have your political freedom here has less and less meaning as more and more people move into the area. And then the history of South Africa has dramatically changed, and we'll go over some of that again tomorrow by the discovery of diamonds in 1868 in the Kimberley area. We visited the diamond mine at one time, and they took out, these are just some odds and ends, bits and pieces, took out and put on a cloth for us to take a picture of. And of course gold, and that's the main thing. 1886, the main gold reef, as they call it, in the area which is now Johannesburg, was struck, the richest gold-bearing reef in the world. And immediately changed history because many whites poured into the area and they needed labor, and so they set up a contract labor system, migratory labor, where the blacks would come from rural areas, come in there and stay for a year on a contract and go home again, maybe for a month. Very, very cheap labor. And of course the blacks, many of them had no other way to get, no other employment, so they were willing to do it even though it was very tough, difficult work. Those mines sometimes go a mile down underground, straight down, and then tunnels off from the side. It's in the Transvaal, this one. The history is, there are similarities to our history in the terms of what some of the white did, and these were the Dutch or the Afrikaners as they came to be known. They moved into the interior of South Africa traveling in ox wagons. And you can see this is a monument to those pioneers. And you see the replicas of ox wagons. They traveled into the interior with their ox wagons. At night they circled the wagons and sat inside and had their fire and cooked their food. They called it a lager. That's where the word lager comes from. This monument was built and finished in 1938 to commemorate 100 years of the Great Trek and to commemorate the victories that they had over the Zulus, especially as they moved inland. So very similar to, in many ways, to the pioneers in America moving west and taking over the land, and the Aborigines, the local people, were either chased away or killed or made, in this case some of them of course were made slaves or servants. It's called the Voortrekker Monument. The people as they trekked and went inland were called Voortrekkers. Of course, you all know about the whole system of apartheid. That's just a, happens to be a bench, Europeans only, Alien Blancas, the two official languages of the country. Now, this kind of apartheid, this petty apartheid, as they call it, park benches and stuff like that, that's gone. But the basic pillars, as I said, there are still there. But and originally, you had all of this, separate everything, buses, trains, benches, parks, schools, everything, and of course it wasn't separate, it was separate but unequal. And downtown there were no places for blacks to go into, I mean in the center of the city. Then you had these signs which illustrate the Group Areas Act. This is a sign outside of Soweto, the huge African township near Johannesburg, which tells you that this road passes through proclaimed Bantu locations. Any person who enters the locations without a permit renders himself liable to prosecution for contravening the Bantu Urban Areas Consolidation Act 1945 and the location regulations of the City Council of Johannesburg. It's written in four languages. Upper right is Afrikaans, lower left is Sotho, one of the other main African languages, and the other one is Zulu. And I'll read that for you, you can get an idea what Zulu sounds like. The title there is Isipwayiso, which means a warning. Lomgwako udlula phakathi kwamalokishi abantsundu. Noma ubani ongena amalokishi engenayo incwadi yepermit yemvumelo, uzibangela ukumangalelwa ngenxa yokwaphula imithetho yendawo zabantsundu, Urban Areas Consolidation Act 1945, futhi nemithetho yamalokishi yomuzi waseJohannesburg. So that's a very plain sign. You hear what it said. Young African mother with her children in the urban areas. One of the difficult things is as people move into the city, they're often not able to bring their families along. And so we have a very difficult situation there. That illustrates the passbooks which Africans carried. Now they have a different document, but still your identity is there, which class you belong to. That was the book carried by the Africans called a passbook. And if you were caught without that, you were put in jail. And there were thousands of people every year put in jail because they didn't have their passbook on them or because they didn't have the proper stamp in there allowing them to be in the urban areas. That has been changed, but the control of the influx has not changed. So that's one of the things that has to be sorted out as they work for, as they start negotiating now in South Africa. The youth in South Africa grew up in this system, but gradually became more outspoken, more critical than their parents. The youth in Soweto, you've heard the name, the huge township, African settlement outside of Johannesburg. 2 million people live in Soweto. And you can imagine what has been happening there as the pressure has built up in Soweto. And in 1976, on June 16th, the watershed in South African history, many of these young school children you just saw in the picture were staging a protest march to protest the fact the government wanted them to take their courses, their studies in Afrikaans. Now, all children in South Africa have to learn both English and Afrikaans, but they were supposed to take their studies, and they said, we're not going to learn Afrikaans. They marched down the road with protests with posters. Have any of you seen Cry Freedom, or how many have seen Cry Freedom? You remember the end of Cry Freedom when they show a reenactment of this? This is an actual picture of the first African kid who was killed. There were about 600 that were killed or more, shot. Many of them in the back, and many, many wounded. Nobody knows how many thousand. That revolutionized South Africa. Many young blacks left the country at that time to prepare for the armed struggle, and others just became very radicalized and politicized. The detentions began to build up. That's a list of people in detention when I was visiting in South Africa in 85 in a church center. They started listing all the people they knew that were in detention, including Alan Busack and pastors. And at one time, about 25,000 Africans were in detention. One time during the political, when the pot was really boiling in 85, 86, 87, during that time. The police, then the police were becoming more brutal, black and white police both. The Africans had no way to demonstrate besides a peaceful demonstration. And one way, a protest, was a billboard protest. Now that's very interesting. This was downtown Johannesburg, on the edge of downtown. We were driving along there a couple of years ago when I was visiting there, and we saw this poster and we stopped. We couldn't believe our eyes. It was a billboard protest showing the police, you know, chasing an African with a shambok, one of these whips, and all the bad animals around there. Well, 2 days later we came by, this was gone. But it was there for a couple of days. That's Cape Town again, and we're talking now about Africans moving into the city, having to come into the city for work. Again, because the land will not, there's not enough land, and of course people want to come into town, and they have no choice in any case, so they move more and more into town. And as they came into Cape Town, there was a big controversy there during these past years. There wasn't housing, and the government didn't want them to live in certain areas, so the government would bulldoze the shacks, and the people would come back and build up shanties again. And there was a lot of controversy, and there were people living there. Sometimes what would happen would be that a wife and children would come from the rural area because they said, there's nothing here for us, our husband is in Cape Town. They'd come in and the authorities would say, you have no right to be in Cape Town. You are not legally allowed to be in Cape Town, go on back to Transkei. And they would load them on buses and haul them back to Transkei. They would come back again, they would build these kind of houses. And it was just a tug of war during that time. And the kind of houses that they built, this place was called Crossroads. And if you followed it all a few years ago, what was going on, you read the word Crossroads. And it's still a big struggle, and it will be a big problem for South Africa, for the new government, whoever that is, because there just isn't enough housing, and there are more and more people, and a lot of them live in housing like this.
So they're still being transported back and forth from the cities? Are they still having the same problems in there?
Yeah, it's still the same problems. They still don't have, they're backing off a little bit on actually hauling people as they were because they wanted to try and, you know, get in the work toward negotiation. But it's still a problem that they aren't allowed to stay there. The other huge city, of course, and we already touched on, is Johannesburg, called the City of Gold, very modern city. Downtown, you'd think you're in downtown, any downtown city in the United States, except that there may be many black people on the streets. City of Gold, as the Africans call it, E-Gold. And then Soweto, outside of Johannesburg. City of 2 million people. And these people, in order to get a house there, you have to have a job in Johannesburg. And then they commute over the hill about 10, 12, 15 miles away, depending on where you live out here. They commute into town by taxi, by train, by bus, work in the city, come back at night, and stay out here in Soweto. And the houses are built by the municipality, by the government, and they pay a certain amount of rent. What's happening is more and more houses are coming in, and people are building in their backyards, and it's getting more and more crowded here too. And this is, of course, you can imagine, one of the hotbeds. You get 2 million people together, living next door like that, who don't have their rights. So when you, every once in a while in the paper, you see something. It's S-O-W-E-T-O. And another aspect of this whole movement of people is that when men or women are not allowed to, take the men first, not allowed to bring their families in, the men have to live in single-sex hostels. In other words, you come into town, you're married, back in your rural area, you live in rural Washington and you have a job in Seattle, you're not allowed, even if you want to, even if you have the wherewithal, you cannot bring your family into Seattle. You keep, your wife has to stay back where you came from, and you, the only housing available for you is in these dormitories, these hostels. And then there are women who come into town too. Young women who aren't married, basically, or sometimes women who are married, they can't get housing, they have to live in hostels on the other side for single women or for women. That's in Alexandria, that one. Then the removals that we talked about earlier, where the government has removed 3.5 million people. They put them in areas like this. Again, it looks like some of our high plains country. It's very dry, cold in winter, below freezing, in summer very hot. Thing is, there's nothing there. It wouldn't be so bad to live there if you had something. There are about 500,000 people in that settlement living in. They've been moved from all over the central part of South Africa. They're placed there and they said, this is your home, this is where you're going to stay, you have to live here. And then to work, the closest town where they can find jobs is 30 miles away. For some it's 200 miles away, for some it's 300 miles away, going into the gold mines. And that's the housing for some of the people that happens to be members of the Lutheran congregation in that place. Now, briefly, we touch on the work of the Lutheran Church, which is our sister church, the Evangelical Lutheran Church in Southern Africa. We talk more about that again on Thursday. But anyway, congregation in the rural area in Zululand, one of the early congregations where missionaries from Norway began to work over 100 years ago. And then in 1928, the American Lutheran Church, one part of our predecessor churches, was asked to come in and help. So since 1928, American Lutherans have also been working in the Lutheran Church in South Africa. And that's the church in which we work, I mean in the synod. The presiding bishop of the whole church is Bishop Solomon Sirote, and Anna, his wife, and the grandson. There are 7 dioceses in the church, 7 bishops, and he's also the chairperson or the presiding bishop over the church. Solomon Sirote, S-E-R-O-T-E. In the middle, a bishop of one of the other dioceses, special interest to us because that's the area in which we first worked, and I remember this young man when he was a student at the seminary, man with the brown coat and the dark tie, is Bishop Zulu, Simeon Zulu. His name is the same as the name of the Zulu people because there was one tribe that started out and actually dominated the rest of the area, and the people became known as Zulus, even though there are many subgroupings. The other two men, the secretary on the left side, Obed Zondi, and Eli Makoba, the treasurer, of the diocese down in the Taal, one of the seven dioceses of the Lutheran Church. The church has suffered a lot, and again we'll touch on that, but just to touch it as we go by now, Hotso House was the headquarters for the South African Council of Churches, a council which includes all churches in South Africa, basically except the Dutch Reformed White Church. Even the Roman Catholic Church is an observer, member, or is a kind of a, they're not full members. This house was bombed in August 1988, one of the last days of August. Bombed, powerful bombs placed in the basement, and it blew up. The whole inside was destroyed. The offices of the Lutheran Church were also in this building. Offices of some of the Anglican Church, other organizations working to help people. Farsani, again, some of you have heard him speak, heard him, a man on the right with a bow tie. Farsani was imprisoned four times and tortured twice. He's in the States now, Pacific Lutheran Seminary. He's just gone back to visit his homeland. He'll come back again. He's studying here. The man on the left is Ndaganeni Paswana, another pastor who's imprisoned and tortured up in Venda. He was the secretary of the diocese. And again, you see Pastor Bishop Sirota in the middle in the dark coat. He's never been tortured, but he's been harassed and he's had all kinds of trouble as a bishop. And the lone white man there is a German man who at that time was treasurer of the diocese. So these are actually the leaders of the diocese, of the northern diocese of the church, the Lutheran Church in South Africa. Their office building was raided several times by the police. They'd come in and chase people out and go into the files. And they kept harassing the churches all the time because the churches were, even though many people said the churches are too timid, the churches were trying to speak up against the party. People worship in all kinds of settings. This is in rural Zululand, down in the valley, in the area where the Lutheran Church work started many years ago. Very simple kind of a worship structure. Then you have churches in Soweto, like this one. Relatively new church building in one of the Soweto areas. You see the mine dumps in the back. Looks like Holden. When we drove in here, we said Holden looks like Johannesburg. Only they're you know, much more extensive because the mining area goes on for miles and miles and miles. But the same kind of mining, the tailings.
They don't have the trees.
They don't have the trees, that's for sure. One of the mountains. Another very, very nice church structure in Soweto. There are some fine buildings. Then you have the chapels and you have people worshiping in all kinds of settings. Church in that resettlement area that we showed you a little while ago, which was built with funds from the States and Germany and Canada, and on the right a daycare center. Churches are full, I think one can say that, and there's that exuberant singing and dancing in spite of all the problems. As someone has said, one of the reasons maybe that is that when you come to church on Sunday, that's the high point of the week and you get strength to carry on for another week. And it's a place where black people have been able to be free, to be in control, to be in charge during the week. Many of them are servants. Many of them even are domestic servants. They work. They do a lot of the scut work, as we call it. They're always second-class people. But in the church, they're somebody. They're free. It's their church. And they really enjoy that and really let loose. Communion is a high point. The Zulus call Communion Sunday Isonto Elikulu, the big Sunday. And that again is an important source of strength. It's one of the bishops, a very good friend of ours, the ministering communion. And offerings. People are not, this area right here, people are not as poor as in some areas because there's some government offices there and some of them work there. But basically, you know, again, the income is about 14 times smaller than whites. Yet they have offerings, and their aim is to try and support their local parish work. They do get help from America and from Europe, from mission partners, to support other parts of their work. But the local parish, the paying the pastor and the local parish expenses, they try to be self-supporting. And that's encouraged by them and by us, of course. After church, after the offering, after everything, in some of the churches they go outside, and they sing and dance, they move around in circles, shake hands. And again, this joy in the Lord and also in the sense getting strength for the next week. And they know how to celebrate. This was a church dedication in Northern Transvaal. I took this just last year now. A brass band. You may wonder where in the world that came from. Well, there were German missionaries working in this area And wherever German missionaries worked, they brought brass instruments, and the Africans took to it like everything. And I wish they had a recording of this. They were marching into a church dedication, and the band was leading the whole parade, and everyone was excited, moving into this dedication. This dedication service itself, after we got into the church, lasted 5 hours. Africans really know how to celebrate. There were about 10 choirs. Every choir had to sing several numbers, and in between there were greetings from church people and from people around the area thanking and praising and, you know, all this, that we got this new church. And the only thing that saved us, really, because 5 hours is a long time to sit, and they were kind of, they didn't have benches yet. They didn't have money for benches. And they'd taken some small chairs from a school nearby, which were really too small for us, and we were sitting there. But the bishop's wife was very smart. Between all these choirs and these speaking, she said, every time we get a new choir, we'll stand up and dance. And so that band was playing a certain song, and every time in between, we'd stand up and dance around and kind of get loose, because 5 hours is a long time to sit in church. And then after church, we had a feast. And Africans know how to provide hospitality, and food is always very important. And even if they're very poor, if they haven't even come to home and there isn't much there, they always try to give you something. This is the church kitchen for the church dedication. Rice, and usually rice and chicken, and be rice and goat meat, or rice and beef. Basically, if you have not eaten in South Africa unless you've had some kind of meat, but of course there are many, many times they don't have meat. I mean, there are families that wouldn't have meat even during the week. They'd be eating cornmeal porridge and stuff. But when you're going to feast, you have to have meat. In some of the churches, they use the symbol of Amnesty International to show that people are in prison from their church or from neighboring churches, neighboring congregations. So they light that and put it on the altar. The church works in many ways. One is to work with refugees and people who need help in other ways. These men are working in an advice center. The church together, the churches, the South African Council, all the churches set up advice bureaus in some of these areas because people have no recourse to legal help. They have no money to hire lawyers. And so the church sets up offices where people can come. And these young men are some of the people who come and who are there. And when we were there were some women there just coming in to get help. Maybe they've lost their birth certificate. Maybe they don't know, they've lost their rent receipt or whatever. And they come in there and get help from church-related groups. And that happens to be our son talking to these two men. Our son is a missionary right in that area at this time. And these, what's significant too is these men like this are often jailed by the South African authorities. And that all they're doing is trying to help people. I mean, they're not plotting to overthrow the government. They're trying to help people whose husbands are in jail, husbands have been lost, trying to just keep their houses, keep their places, just basic human rights. And often these people, they call them advice officers, often have been put in jail. The women's groups are a powerful group in South African churches. They wear different uniforms, and they meet for Bible study on Thursday. It's always Thursday, and then they have time, depending on some days, not every time, but they go out and visit sick people, or they visit people who have had death in the family. And then on Sundays when they come to church, they wear their uniforms, and they're very powerful. They sing and they dance, and this was a group that was showing off some of their, they were just singing and dancing for us when we visited in Soweto.
What's hanging in their hands? Are those long purses or what?
They would be purses, yeah.
Oh,
right.
Okay, bags. Like.
Yeah, these did have bags. And in the country, you know, it would be more bags. But some of these women are, obviously, they've got jobs, and they'll, you know, they've got enough money to buy something like a purse. And, well, some would be hymnals, but the things that are hanging would be purses, aren't they? Yeah. And then to show the kind of work they do, they visit in hospitals. This is another place in a hospital where they visit, pray for people. They have two names for these women, the group. One is Abasizigazi, which means helping ones. Another one is Abatandazi, which means the praying ones. And their logo is praying hands and a cross. And in Swaziland, this group of women there in that area got a gift from the ALCW, before the merger, the ALCW of Southwestern Minnesota, and building a center in Swaziland, which is a part of the South African church, it's another diocese, where they can have classes on nutrition, on childcare, even on gardening, on taking care of chickens, and one part is pigs. They said they want to raise pigs so they can have money. And we visited there last year. The woman on the left in the red jacket is Jean Rapp, the past president of the women of the ELCA, who was just, you know, they've just elected a new president. And on the right, in the middle, Nancy Hansen, a volunteer from our home church in Bloomington, Minnesota. And then Mary Lowe, we have another picture of her, an intern from Lutheran Northwestern, who the people tell me has been here at Holden. I don't know how many times she's been here. She's an intern who is interning in Swaziland from Lutheran Northwestern Theological Seminary. Then the Swedish missionary pastor who works with some of these, and then the rest are some of the Swazi women who are working, trying to get this center built up. Sunday schools in African churches like we do, although they don't have many materials, they're lucky if they have any kind of Sunday school material. Sometimes it's just someone who reads from the Bible and tells them a Bible story, which is fine, but you know, it's nice to have material. So they have a problem with materials. Youth groups. What's different about some of the youth groups is that, like these youth, some of these kids have been in jail just because they have not tried to overthrow the government, because they've just said we don't agree with what's going on. And the government sometimes targets the youth. There have been thousands of young people in South Africa in prison and in detention. And in this particular place, happens to be again where our son is, so I've got a lot of pictures from there, but some of these kids were just, the police came in the church and just hauled them out. They were having a youth meeting, hauled them out of church and put them in jail. And singing is a powerful means, again, for them of expression, of strengthening their faith, of protest. They will sing. This is a beautiful choir, beautiful singing choir in Transvaal. And they'll sing one song that will be a real good old gospel chorus. And the next song will be a protest song. You know, we got to overthrow the government. We got to get rid of this government. We got to get rid of party. And they go back and forth. It's all a part of that holistic view of life. And it would be wonderful if one could take a choir like this and just transport them over. Theological training for pastors. There are two branches of the seminary in South Africa, training black pastors to work in the church there, black and colored pastors. Rumpumulu is part of the seminary chapel, where they have their chapel services like any seminary does. There has been one ELCA pastor, or before that ALC pastor there. The last one who served there was Rolf Assing. Some of you may know the name, has worked with Lutheran, before the Lutheran Standard in Augsburg. We are in the process of recruiting another one. The church has asked us. They say we have African professors. We also want some professors from other countries. We'd like to have a balance on our faculty. So just a recent addition, a very proud and happy addition, a women's dormitory, because they have more and more women theologians. There are several women pastors in the church. The church does ordain women. Some of the African churches do and some don't. This church ordains women. And this dormitory was just completed with funds from Europe and the United States for women pastors, women theologians, I mean theological students. And then the other seminary is up on the other side, up north of Johannesburg, in an area which is quite a bit drier. So there are two branches and they work together in training African pastors for work in the church there. Churches also try to do some other things. In one church, they're trying to encourage the people to have a small garden, so they plant a garden in the churchyard to kind of be a model with fruit trees and vegetables. So even if they don't have much, a little garden to give some food for the children and a little bit of green in the midst of all the bleakness. Church has also sponsored an arts and crafts center in Natal where people have learn to weave and to do pottery. They have the basic skills, but they've learned to do things to the pottery, for instance, is something they've done from time immemorial, but to continue to develop this. And many of the women who do this are women who had only a few years of school, and it's just wonderful to see what they've been able to do. And some of their pottery has won international prizes and international exhibitions. Beautiful, beautiful stuff. And the tapestries, this is a tapestry they did which depicts the installation of the second Zulu bishop. And that's all done. That woman who did that probably hasn't had more than a few years of school, and she just has a little pattern. They prepare the wool, and they do everything at this place, and then end up weaving these tapestries on large looms. This thing is probably about, 6 by 8 feet or a little bit more. You can't tell. Then there are day nurseries in some areas for the children. I mentioned that many of the women and men have to go to where they work. Even the women often have to leave early in the morning and ride 30 miles on an old bus to get to work, come back late at night. So one thing the church tries to do, and it's hard because it takes a lot of money, so people can't afford to support it, is have day nurseries where the kids can be during the day when the parents, maybe the father's in Johannesburg and the mother's 30 miles away all day. Nobody at home. Church has one home for the aged. Should have more, because this is changing in South Africa. Originally, in African society, everyone was cared for in the home. Built-in social security system. The old people, anyone that had mental deficiency, anybody, they were just cared for in the home, in the village, in the kraal. This is changing. So now you have women, old people, who have no place to go. Now, maybe their children are in Johannesburg, there's no place. So the church is providing a place for some of them, at least. Yeah, that's especially the older women want to cover their heads. It's just a custom. The women, the young ones don't. But the old ones.
The girls have their heads covered.
Yeah. Well, you see less and less of the children and the kids, but the old people do that. The history of our involvement, as I mentioned, goes back. But the Norwegian missionaries came into this area in 1844, and these are the graves of some of the pioneer missionaries. And later on, missionaries from America came in. Now we have an intern, Mary Lowe, as I mentioned before, she's actually from Alaska. She's interning there this year, and there will be another one coming in next year with the intern supervisor, one missionary and one African pastor. The woman-to-woman program, we had a program a couple years ago, a woman from there came, Basilim Zeniso. She has her logo, remember the logo, those of you from the old ALC. Now we had another program this year for women coming, so we continue that program. And then Jean Rapp met a friend of hers, Noma Mohali. They had met in the States, and by chance they met in South Africa. She's the wife of a professor, that woman on the left, Noma. And Jean Rapp, the past president of our women. So it was kind of fun for them to have an unscheduled reunion in South Africa. There's a companion church program being developed, so each diocese in South Africa will have a sister synod in the ELCA. And the Synod of Chicago, Metro Chicago, Bishop Sherman Hicks on the right, it's not a good picture of him, but he's the Bishop of Chicago, will be linked up with the Johannesburg Diocese, Bishop Manus Buthelezi in the middle. And they met last year in South Africa, beginning to talk about ways in which the American synod can relate to the diocese in South Africa. And each of the dioceses in South Africa will be linked up with another, with a synod of the ELCA. And other synods in our church are going to be linked up. Have any of you heard now about synods that you're in that are going to have sister churches or partner churches overseas? Yeah.
I think North East Minnesota is going
to
have one in India.
Yeah. Eventually you will hear about it, if that you will be having a sister church or sister. So that's going to be an interesting development. Another diocese in South Africa will have a sister synod here. And this man was telling us, when we get a sister synod in America, we want them to send us an evangelist to work with us. Even if he doesn't talk Zulu, I need encouragement. I'm an evangelist. I get tired. Have him come and work with me and walk with me for a couple months out in the hills just to encourage me. And that was interesting. He didn't ask for money. He said, we want an evangelist to come and live with us and encourage us. And that's southwestern Minnesota, and I hope they can send somebody out there eventually. There was a consultation with all the partners last year. I won't go into that this time. We've had ties. You know the man on the left, our bishop, and on the right, Modihe Tsele, who was here not so long ago. Those of their staff here that were here, Molife Tsele and Modihe Tsele were here. He was a pastor who was detained for 2 years by the South African authorities. This was while he was in detention. We were in South Africa, and we all happened to meet. Bishop Joseph was going one way and I was going another way, but we met in Johannesburg and she came to meet us and we got this picture. That at that time her husband was still in prison. He's out now, is a student at LSTC in Chicago. And they were here a few weeks ago and spent a couple weeks, I think, on staff. I mean, I don't think, I know they were. Churches in South Africa still want partnership with us. They ask for our prayers, they ask for our support. They asked for our concern about the changing the situation of apartheid and the future of South Africa. Of course, nobody knows, but hopefully there will be a new future. We'll be talking the next couple of days about the political involvement, political developments and church involvement, so we'll come back to it again. We'll close with this slide of a church in Northern Transvaal. This is the church where we had the five-hour dedication. And there, the verse that they used, the own verse that they decided to put in front of their church, it's in Sotho. And Dumela Morena Jesu Christe Hemotlo Poloso. That's not my language. But anyway, it means believe in the Lord Jesus Christ and you will be saved. And that's the message that that church has, and that's a good place to stop as far as the slides. And we've got a few minutes, I believe. Just about two or three before end of the session.
Are there any white Lutherans in South Africa?
Yes, there are. Just put that on the can. Just push it up and then just put it. Yes, there are. Thank you. Just leave it there.
Are there any?
Yes, there are. There are 30,000 white Lutherans of German descent. We didn't talk a lot about the Church of Church. The Black Church has about 600,000 members. It has the seven dioceses. The white German churches are, well, they're up here, and they, as some of you know, there's been a constant conflict there. They have been invited to join the Black Church, and they didn't. And in 1977, at Dar es Salaam, at the Lutheran World Federation Assembly, they were excommunicated from the Lutheran World Federation until they can come into full altar and pulpit fellowship with the white, with the Black Lutherans. So that's a, now they are talking about merging the Black and the White Lutherans. Yep.
I'm struck with the similarities on the homelands, mm-hmm. and the reservations, yep. in this country.
Yep.
Another thing that struck me is looking at the pictures and the poverty that's there in South Africa is very much the poverty that I saw in Korea in 1963. Mm-hmm. I remember that they would, the poor Koreans would make houses out of beer cans and Coke cans.
Mm-hmm.
They would, the boys could cut them open and use that for sidewalks. And I would hope 30 years from now that the poverty in South Africa is replaced with movement in the direction that Korea has, with some industrialization and some growing of the world.
The resources are there.
Yeah.
It's one of the richest countries in the world, but you got to find a way of changing that system, and that's the $64 billion question that they're going to be working with. Yeah.
Jim was a white person in South Africa, and I guess I also wonder, when you say a white person writes a book criticizing the South African government,
yeah.
How free are they to do that? How free are you to criticize them when they even go over there? Well, what happens? Is there subtle repression? I'm always curious about how whites look. You don't like the situation. How free you are?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's not. It takes a long time to answer, but I'll try to be short. There are all kinds of gradations in this thing. It got to be. In latter years, that the one thing that they looked for was if you advocated violent overthrow of the government, then you were, or if you were an open member of the African National Congress, which was outlawed. It was a criminal offense to belong to the African National Congress. So any white that they found who was a card-carrying member, because the African National Congress was underground, that was, you were put in jail. So not many whites actually belonged. Another thing, of course, was a criminal offense was advocating for sanctions the last year. That was a criminal offense. There were so many gradations of this. There were whites who, as long as you just criticize apartheid, you might be harassed, you might not be harassed. Then there were people like Beres Nordia. We'll talk about him, this famous Afrikaner who went against his own people, and they couldn't take that, and he was in 7 years in house arrest. And he never once advocated violent overthrow of the government. He just said, we've got to change the system. And he spoke out very strongly that we've got it. And he came from out from within them. He was an Afrikaner, and that was probably harder for them to swallow. There were outsiders. It varied a lot. For instance, in Cape Town area, three missionaries were sent home within the period of 2 years back in 86, 87. Swedish family, Well, first of all, the German family. And then, because of all that business, then, you know, we had a family, the Birchfield family, and Red and Susie. They were involved with this German, so after a while, people were watching them, and we figured some people in the congregation, because there are informers in congregations. They were with a colored congregation. They were told that they would have to leave, and then later a Swedish family. And none of these families had advocated overthrow the government. We had another missionary family in Johannesburg, very outspoken, and wrote stuff back and were very involved, and they were there the whole time and left peacefully. Well, actually the Solner, some of you know Tom and Joyce Solner. So it varied a lot, whether you were a foreigner or whether you were a local person. There was always some kind of harassment for anyone, but I don't vary a lot. And even when you're going back to get passport or visas, 1 year you'd get a visa, I'd get a visa really easy, next year it was very hard, I wouldn't get it, and it would take time to get it. It wasn't monolithic, but the main thing was violent overthrow of the government, member of ANC, or later on advocating sanctions. Yeah?
You talk about the whites, there's really two divisions of whites, the Afrikaners and the British whites.
Yeah, about, if you can break it down several ways, roughly 60% of the whites are from Afrikaner background, and we'll talk about that tomorrow, how they got there, 40% British, but then mixed in with the Afrikaners, of course, originally were the French, Huguenots, and then there were some Germans also in there. But they're smaller groupings. And then, of course, now you got Portuguese, you got people from Zimbabwe. But that, if you want to break it down roughly, say 60% came out of the Afrikaner background, 40% out of the British.
Is de Klerk, is he an Afrikaner?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. They have been, since 1948, that party, the Nationalist Party, has been in power. But there have been British people on both sides of the fence, too. It hasn't been just a 60-40, you know. There have been British who have supported the system, too, and British background people. So it gets mixed up. Go ahead, sir. Go ahead, yeah.
I was going to say, you just mentioned Zimbabwe. Is that going to be, or could that be a model for South Africa?
I think it could. In fact, I know it could, and that's one reason South Africa tried to destabilize it until recently. They're having their problems, but Zimbabwe, and I just talked to someone again about that. I've only been there a few times, and I've been on visits, I was there again, but I've talked to other people who spent more time. They're having their problems, but at least whites are allowed to stay. Whites have not been forced to give up their land. There's a black government. They had the internal fighting, and some of that between black, some of that was fomented by South Africa giving aid to the other group that was trying to oust the government, because it was very hard for South Africa to accept the fact that on the borders was a black government that actually, I mean, things were not in complete chaos, and whites were not being killed, and whites were not being run out of the country.
It goes against their propaganda.
That's why at Solveig Chess's, if you go to her, she talks about the destabilization of Angola and Mozambique. It's one of the reasons, too, they've been destabilizing, because that was even harder to take, because those countries said they were communist or Marxist, you know, and then to have black governments calling themselves Marxist on their borders, and maybe even, you know, something could work, was very hard. So Zimbabwe was hard for them to swallow, but they're swallowing it now more. They have to, because now they're trying to say we want peace in the region. I mean, at least Zimbabwe, they're swallowing it. And there are some, I've heard there's some Zimbabweans going back who fled into South Africa. But then others who came down are some of the most conservative and reactionary whites in South Africa. And that creates another problem. They say this: we got out of Zimbabwe. We're not going to give up again. We're going to hang on to our privilege. Well, tomorrow, as I said, if some of you hadn't come in, tomorrow we're going to talk about why is South Africa the way it is. Some perspectives, a historical sketch, and then on Thursday, what the church has been doing. So, in a sense, we're going to back up and take a little more time on what we talked about today. So, if you can come back, then we'll go into more detail. There are some handouts here, a few still left, and the books which I mentioned before some of you came in, there are two books in the library, in the bookstore rather, The Church Struggle by John DeGruchy, Janelle's dad, and one by Albert Nolan, God in South Africa. Very good. And there are others too, but These two are on sale or on a table, not on sale, but they're books that relate to our classes, and we're supposed to encourage people to buy them. In fact, Peter Chesson says they tell us if we don't sell them, we have to buy the ones, but I think they're just good. Anyway, we'll see you again.
Thank you.